Thank you, Rabbi Solish, for your generous welcome. It's a joy to be here tonight. This is such a cool venue. Mazel tov on the acquisition of this building. And I'll just echo Rabbi Solish. May you all go from strength to strength. It's very exciting. So tonight we're here to speak about personal and professional relationships. To paraphrase Dickens, people are the best part of life and the worst part of life. Our interpersonal relationships are the most difficult, but the most satisfying aspect of our existence. Working with people can be extremely gratifying, even uplifting, or acutely painful and difficult. So pathologists have an easier but potentially less satisfying job than do internists, in the same way that creating cakes is less stressful than is working in the HR department of a major corporation. No matter what we're doing, we all have to be in relationships. So we've gathered to talk about friendships, about relating to our coworkers, our family members, our spouses, our children, and who among us cannot use some help in this direction. I'm going to lead with a story I heard from my paternal grandfather many, many times over, and it only appreciates in value as I grow older. He spoke about a son-in-law who found himself in a position where he just felt it was necessary to buy his mother-in-law a gift. He wasn't particularly fond of his mother-in-law, but this is what the occasion called for. And so he dutifully took himself to a gift shop and was perusing the aisles. And he actually became very intrigued by the beautiful offerings, so much so that he inadvertently knocked over a vase. And to his great misfortune, this was an especially expensive vase. So now he has to pay for a broken vase, and he has to buy another gift for a woman he doesn't love in the first place. And then he had a brilliant idea. He gathered up all the pieces of the vase he had broken. He brought them to the front, and he asked the person there to please pack it for him. And in his mind, he thought to himself, this is perfect. I'll present the box to my mother-in-law. I will slip on the proverbial banana peel. I will make all the right exclamations about how sorry I am. Surely she will say that it's the thought that counts and she's sure that it's fine. And at least I'll cut my losses. And so as they're packing up his gift, he starts looking around again and daydreaming about what he might buy for somebody he actually liked. And then they snap him out of his reverie and tell him that his gift is ready to take home. And it's beautifully wrapped and the bow is just perfect, and he actually gets enthused about this prospect, and he goes to his mother-in-law and he presents her with a gift, and she makes all the right noises and he makes all the right exclamations, and then he falls and the package falls out of his hands and he is very upset. Was it David that said he's going to stick to the script? This guy sticks to the script. And he says, it's a delicate gift. I hope it's okay. She opens the box carefully, and lo, each piece of the vase had been wrapped separately. Now, I don't know if this story ever actually happened or not, but I continue to understand just how important this story is, because oftentimes, in seeking to address an issue, a problem, instead of looking for a holistic way of approaching what it is we seek, we take the pieces and we wrap them individually. We address the shards as opposed to looking for a global or a wholeness. And I suggest that we do that a lot in terms of our relationships. And I think that it might be a good idea to address the various relationships in our lives in a less differentiated way, in a more holistic manner. And to this end, I want to share some ancient wisdom with you. So at this point, you should all have papers that you can refer to. While the concept of the world being comprised of four basic elements. And you could follow along now if you look at table one. That's the one on the top of the page. And going from the bottom of the chart upward, you have afar, earth, mayim, water, ruach, air, and esh, fire. So the concept of the world being comprised of these four basic elements is widely attributed to Aristotle and some of his contemporaries. But in fact, we find mention of this concept in the first book of Jewish mysticism known as Sefer HaYetzirah, which is attributed by at least some to Adam and by others to Abraham. So it's fair to say it's been around in Jewish thought for a long, long time. Now, related to this foursome is another, if you look at table two, and that is the notion of different categories in creation. So again, if you look from the bottom going upwards, we have domim, the inanimate, tzomeach, the vegetative strata, chai, the animal kingdom, and midaber, the one who speaks, otherwise known as the human. And I'd like to suggest that understanding some basic ideas about these two sets of four and how our psyches can be understood as relating to these can change the way we relate to everyone and anyone. So let's begin by looking at the four strata or levels of creation. Clearly, there's an ascending hierarchy, with the inanimate being the most lowly and man being the pinnacle of creation. A stone. A stone can simply be. A plant. A plant can grow and be pretty. An animal can move, feed, and fend for itself and its young, and even communicate quite brilliantly. Man. Only man has endless capacity to generate language. Only man has a self and a higher consciousness, a sense of self, that is. And only man can make moral decisions. But if you look at this alleged hierarchy, there is a startling, even sobering side to this. And that is that quite counterintuitively, we find that the higher you ascend in this hierarchy, on the ladder of existence, as it were, the greater the level of neediness and dependence. A rock, for instance. What does a rock need? No one. Nothing. You have nothing to add to the existence of a rock. Don't try to be helpful. Vegetation needs soil and rain. Animal needs include food, shelter, safety for itself and its young, and so forth. And our needs as humans, they can only be termed endless. Question for your consideration. Are we needier because we are more capable, or are we more capable because we are more needy? I seek your opinion. I think it's a cycle. You think it's a cycle? Okay. All right, I'll let you ponder this and I'll tell you what I'm thinking. It turns out that we're more capable because we're needier. Plants can afford to remain stationary because essentially all they need is earth and water. And you might have noticed that some plants need sun, and those plants move and grow in the direction of the sunlight. Animals, they don't have that luxury. They need to find nourishment, they need to find shelter, they need to propagate the species, protect their young, so they need to move beyond their bit of earth where they were born. Unlike vegetation, they cannot remain stationary. Life forces them to move and utilize the various aspects of their God-created bodies, including their intellect, to effect the ends they need to survive. The human being has all the needs of an animal, yes, plus the most difficult of all needs to meet, the needs of a self-conscious being equipped with a moral compass, or at least the knowledge that there ought to be one. This kind of being seeks validation, recognition. We yearn for approval, for love, and even for consummate union. We have a need to make a mark, to accomplish, to contribute. This being has a yen to expand one's horizons and integrate the new into one's experience. We're always seeking more, to discover a new world, to rise above ourselves, to take it, whatever the it is, at a certain point to the next level. Not satisfied to know where we are, we want to know where we came from and where we are going next. In other words, we have a desperate need for relationships. And that's what makes human life so deliciously deep and so exasperatingly complex. We are forced by our distinctive needs to move in our lives beyond the levels of inanimate vegetation and the basic and brute animal instincts, and to live truly as humans and fully. So again, one's needs bring us to develop certain capabilities. And just to concretize this, our math skills today are arguably much weaker since the invention of the calculator. Our memories go completely unused. I remember my grandfather being 90 and having what seemed to me hundreds of telephones stored in his memory, telephone numbers. Now people don't know their own telephone number, but why should they? And research, what does research even mean today when all you have to do is canvas the net, with most people simply just using Google instead of anything else? So it seems that we do in response to a need. But here's the most interesting thing about us humans. In essence, we just want to be left alone. We don't want to do. We want to be inanimate. We want to just be. But life catapults us into movement. We're forced to move and shake, to leave our homes, to wander the earth, to collect, shape, and harness its energies in our service. We must learn to relate to others and work with them. We're forced to relate on these levels because we simply cannot survive otherwise. Now, if life is good, we enjoy these overtures. We enjoy the challenge. We enjoy the new and interesting experiences. We enjoy exploring the world. But, as Yogi Berra once said, the best parts of the trip are leaving and coming home. Especially coming home. Why? Because only in our home, in our inanimate space, are there no external demands made on us. This is where we don't have to prove ourselves. We don't have to perform. We don't have to gauge reactions. We can let down our hair, kick off our heels, not worry about flatulence. We don't have to adjust our approach. We don't have to measure our words, massage egos. We can just be. This is what the Talmud means when it says that a man is not a man if he doesn't have a home, a place to come home to roost, a place where one's raw essence can be exposed. For years, I submit, there was a Talmudic adage that really rankled. And that was, Beito zu ishto. One's home is one's wife. And to my ears, this sounded extremely misogynist. But I happened upon the Hasidic, the Kabbalistic understanding of this, and it changed a lot for me. Your home is where your wife is, or your home is where your spouse is, because ideally your spouse, similarly to the walls of your home, is not a force you have to impress, entertain, woo, or wow. Your spouse accepts you just the way you are, warts and all. Your domain, your inanimate, essential aspect can just connect to their domain. The Kabbalah explains that, in fact, the domain aspect of our personality, the inanimate, is actually the deepest, most essential self. It is who we are, truly, our pristine core, before we begin to express and project and communicate. In other words, evolution is actually a state of devolution. The further and wider and more complex and intricate our self-expression, the more profoundly we move away from our essential self. And I think I can concretize this most clearly by taking the example of a parent-child relationship. Imagine if somebody asked me why I love my son Shmuley. And I say, oh my God, Shmuley? I mean, he speaks 16 languages. He plays 18 instruments. He cooks the most amazing meals. He cleans the house. He never got anything less than 118 on any exam. And at this point, you should be calling Child Protection Services because I am clearly an unfit parent. Because the only response to why I love Shmuley or anybody else is because they are my child. Because of his inanimate aspect, because of his core, because of who he is. And if, God forbid, he couldn't speak, I would love him less. And if he couldn't walk, I would love him less. So we could see that there is a way for people to relate on this very, very deep, profound, unadorned level, not contingent on what they do or don't do, who they are or are not, as it were. Another example, just trying to make this practical, jealousy. The Talmud says that a person is jealous of everyone save for their child and their student. Why not your child or your student? Because they can never be your competitors. They never were, they never will be. Why? Because you've put yourself into them. They are part of you. Their success is important to you. Their achievements bring you pleasure and happiness. Which means, it seems to me, that the broader we make our team, the less jealous we will feel. What this means is that to find success in all of our relationships, to widen the lens, we have to find a way to relate domem to domem, inanimate, inanimate, core to core with everyone, not only our soulmates or our children. So how do we do this? So to begin to answer that most important question, we must first understand, just very, very quickly, what plagues our relationships? What are the most common problems or challenges to blissful unity or even peaceful coexistence? Let's go with peaceful coexistence for tonight. So the Kabbalah teaches, as do various forms of ancient philosophies and modern schools of psychology, and I'm guessing that there are at least a dozen people sitting in the room right now who work in companies or other environments where people are tested for their personality types and are actually put on teams or in cubicles sitting next to people with whom they will better get along. This is very, very popular now. These basic prototypes or properties are our most salient features, but of course each person is very complex and is comprised of all of these properties to some extent. Now, these basic properties or modalities of expression can be used in a healthy way or the opposite. This means that all of our interpersonal issues, difficulties, pathologies fall into one of four categories. And again, I refer you to the top chart, earth, water, air, and fire. So all of us are actually a combination of all four, which is why from the moment we begin to live in this combination, we begin to die a little bit incrementally. In and of itself, these elements are eternal. They will never become extinct. But in combination, they immediately begin the process of decay. Paradoxically, what makes us tick also makes us fall apart, becomes a source of our tension. We can either build on these four or crumble because of them. So let's take a look. There are people who suffer earth syndrome, afar. They're stuck. They suffer heaviness, which can manifest as laziness or sloth, the inability to relate to others or do what's necessary to nurture a relationship. Also coming out of the earth syndrome is despondency. Laziness comes from the fact that I don't want to move from my default state, and sadness or despondency can be understood as coming from not having all that I might if I actually did move. We're doing this quickly, so we're moving to water. Water, as we all know, is the source of all life, and in the analog is the glue of all relationships. Now, there are many who do relate to others, but in the water pathology, it's not a healthy relationship. It's a one-way street, a singular goal, to see what they can get out of that person. This is the water-driven illness. It generates desires and lusts. What can I get out of this person, this relationship, this situation, with no eye towards the other person for who they are or what they might need? This can be stimulated by a person who feels her despondency and seeks to get out of it, or has never felt truly loved and cared for, and they're seeking to numb themselves by satisfying their desire. Alternatively, there's ruach, the ear syndrome, the insatiable quest to feed or stoke oneself through what we Americans call fun. Frivolity, essentially content-free behavior, silliness, sarcasm, all of which successfully anesthetizes them to the inner turmoil, allows them to skirt or be distracted from issues of reality and substance. Like the water-based illness, the ear syndrome can lead to addiction, which is the result of running away. It's the ill-conceived solution. Addiction is not a problem. It's an ill-conceived solution to a problem. And if it's ear-driven, it's just as unhealthy as the water model, but it manifests in a slightly different fashion. But it's another way of running away from the source of angst within. Note, I want to attribute this correctly to Rabbi Dr. Tursky, who teaches that only man can succumb to addiction. An animal can never eat too much, ingest harmful substances. This is the result of having a self and a higher consciousness that plagues the person. And finally, and most ubiquitous, and we'll all recognize this, is fire, arrogance, anger, the need to subsume and consume someone within oneself. There's a fascinating law in the discussion about what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath. And while it's forbidden, it's not considered a classic breach, a milacha, a breach of the Sabbath on the biblical level to break a vessel on Shabbat, if it's not for constructive purposes. But if one breaks a vessel out of anger, that is the quintessential expression of milacha, because that is considered halachically constructive. It's fascinating. Because anger is about breaking someone else. So breaking something, shover kelim b'chamaso, is a creative accomplishment towards the end, towards breaking the person you want to hurt. This, by the way, is why pity neutralizes anger. Because when you realize the person you're angry at is already broken, you can calm down. Just kind of like a sad commentary on how we work, but it's true. Now, clearly, any one of these four areas of pathology will kill a relationship. So how can we find a way to deal with these issues? We can, of course, wrap each shard, each part of the vase separately. We can take each one of these issues or shortcomings and find some basic, essential, overarching way. Or we can find some basic way to completely change our orientation. And I want to suggest that we can do that by going back to what we said earlier about our domim, our inanimate, our most essential level, by further considering who we are on that level. So I have another question for you, and this is going to be easy. Who would you say is a more healthy, deeply balanced, secure person? The person who has an insatiable need for the limelight, or a person who's very capable, but will stay in the background until they see that what they have to offer is necessary and then will step forward? The latter. Are we concurring? Are we challenging? Okay. Are you sure you're Jewish? Everybody's agreeing? Okay. You all agree because it's simple. It's not rocket science. And I want to suggest that the difference between these two people is the difference between what earth and gold are worth. So what is earth worth? Pure, unadulterated dirt, mud, gravel, what's it worth?
Bupkis.
Anybody care to challenge that?
Priceless.
Sorry?
Priceless.
When is it priceless?
When it's in New York City.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a contingent, contextual worth. That's how real estate works. What about gold? Gold, on the other hand, has inherent worth, and you can Google this and see how much an ounce of gold is worth today on the world market. Now, if you turn it into jewelry, it may be worth slightly more because of the workmanship, but relatively little more. Its overwhelming worth is its inherent and completely independent value. I want to suggest that what we can learn tonight from these two breakdowns of what's going on inside of us is we have to look deeply and sincerely and in truth at who we are on the domem level, on the inanimate level. And we have to realize that we are gold, that our soul, our expression of pure divinity within each one of us, makes us inherently valuable. We are worthy, we are good, we are great. If we are simply a coincidence, a result of some random evolutionary mutation, I am worth only what I make of myself. But if God created me, put me here, at this time, in this form, I am inherently of infinite and incalculable worth. Now, of course, we have to be careful with this. The feeling of I, of ego, is a double-edged sword. It's the most powerful force for good and the most pernicious agent of destruction. It can only be channeled properly for the good if it's tempered. So on the one hand, there is the indubitable fact that I am important, I make a difference, I am in charge. And on the other hand, there's a certain knowledge that this is true only insofar as my actions reflect and bring glory to the creator of all. So I'm guessing that in your travels, in your studies, you've heard the famous story about how a person should always have two papers in their pocket. In one pocket, it should say, the world was created for me. And in the other pocket, the paper should say, I am but just dust and ashes. Jewish law teaches that there are legalities that can be affected by proxy. And in those cases, the messenger, the agent, acts as if they are the person themselves. For instance, a man can divorce his wife via proxy. And the proxy simply becomes the conduit through which what A must accomplish is accomplished, albeit by B. But here's a fascinating aspect of this law. In order to act as a shaliach, as a proxy in Jewish law, as a messenger of another, one must be an adult with full capacity to think independently. In other words, you can only feel someone else's self if you are conscious of your own. You can only understand what it means that someone else is gold when you understand that you are gold. And when we realize that, a wondrous thing happens. It is so emancipating. We no longer have to prove ourselves. We don't have to become anything to prove our worth. We simply have to be the best version of who we are already. For instance, the Mishnah says that whoever runs away from honor and glory will have honor and glory run after them. You know why? People want to get behind a person that exudes such a sense of real self-worth and composure. It's very compelling. People want to follow that kind of quiet strength. We have to meditate on this concept and integrate this properly. I am gold. That's who I am at my core. That is what I am on the domem level, not only to my spouse or to my parents who love me unconditionally, but that is who I am. And then we can relax. We can stop molding ourselves into what we're not. We can concentrate on our relationships that flow from a place of strength and therefore give rather than take. For example, why is it so hard to take a compliment? Perhaps because the more you need it, the more uncomfortable it is to hear it. The more you craved it, the more vulnerable you are, the more difficult it is to acknowledge that, and the more difficult it is for that kind of person to give a compliment to someone else. They're too busy massaging their inner insecurity. Said differently, people with a healthier sense of self-esteem, beginning with the premise that I am gold, actually have an easier time being vulnerable, taking from someone else. They can more easily afford to give someone the great joy and pleasure of being a necessary and contributing factor in their lives instead of being invincible and impermeable. When we recognize that we are gold, not dirt, we can begin to relate to other people from a whole different point of departure, a point of strength. Here's what it might look like. If I'm gold, my earth is not heaviness. It's my stability. It's my ability to hear someone else out, even to take direction or suggestion. Imagine that. I would call that maturity. Instead of heaviness in a gold-based relationship, the earth gives me a rock-solid basis. It gives birth to commitment and devotion and humility. And this is another counterintuitive thought, but arrogance is very, if not most often, the result, very often, not always, but most often, the result of insecurity. My water, if I'm gold, allows me to love rather than to lust. I want to do something for you. That gives me more pleasure than taking. Remember, in a healthy relationship, water makes things grow. Let's understand this for a minute. Much of what we do is driven by guilt or a feeling of, I should do this or I must do this. But if we free ourselves and we concentrate on what we want to give, we can get a lot further. It's true that guilt or commitment can be a great motivator, but often it ends in resentment. But if that same overture or work comes from a place of free will, then again, counterintuitively, it can be selfless rather than selfish. Yes, if you want to give someone and you're giving them, you're actually being selfless, not selfish, because you're concentrating on meeting your need. You want to give. And counterintuitively, you're giving them selflessly rather than concentrating on what they need, which you're begrudgingly giving them so you could check it off a list to assuage your guilt. If I'm gold, said differently, and you need me to be turned into a vase, I'll be a vase. You need me to be a clock, I'll be a clock. I'm gold no matter which way you change me. Ear, instead of frivolity and sarcasm or fun, ear in a healthy relationship is sheer happiness, which always flows from giving rather than taking. True happiness has everything to do with humility. The arrogant person can never truly be happy because they even can never be thankful, never be appreciative, and never feel like they have enough. And finally, in a healthy place, fire is about passion and leadership. It's not about consuming the other in my flame. It's about sharing the warmth and the light to inspire others. Imagine how much this one idea can change our lives. We are all 24 karat gold, a veritable aspect of the divine. So how can I treat you as anything less? And I'm gold, so why would I want to? Or how could I treat you like anything less? So ladies and gentlemen, take that to the bank. It's worth a lot today. And have a good evening.